Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, Congressman Barney Frank. My guest is the legendary Barney Frank, a man who needs no introduction. He's written a book called Frank. He is on a book tour, and it's a pleasure to have one of the most interesting and colorful congressmen in American history here in the studio. Congressman, thank you for being here.
I'm glad to have the opportunity.
You were sort of a man who, whatever big career decision you made, it always seemed to go the other way. You never thought you'd be in public office because of your sexuality, and then things kept happening.
Well, it's an important message to particularly people have this image, oh, if I want to be in politics, I have to carefully plan everything out, and oh, if it's all not in place by the time I'm 19, it's never going to work out. There's an element of chance, and particularly if you're talking about elected office. I think it may have something in common with entertainment. I mean, for most jobs, if you want to be a construction worker, a doctor, a teacher, a chef, et cetera, there'll be a place available for you. But there are a couple of places, and elected office is one. There are only a handful of elected officials throughout the country. And what you need is, no matter how much talent you have and how hard you work, if almost always somebody else has to do something over which you have no control to make it available for you. I write about Tip O'Neill in this book. Tip O'Neill became a congressman because John Kennedy, contrary to everybody's expectation, gave up a safe congressional seat for an uphill Senate race. And then O'Neill became speaker because Hale Boggs got killed in the plane crash. I mean, in my case, in the first place, several times other people suggested it to me, and then some totally unexpected things happened that created the opening. Now, I don't mean to suggest you can be entirely passive. When the opening is there, there's no automatic nod that you're going to fill it. You have to then work hard. You have to be ready. You have to take advantage of it. I guess the best way to say it is you can't create the waves. You just have to be ready to ride them when they appear.
You're a nice Jewish boy, grew up in New Jersey, and went off to Harvard, and then your dad died, and your life took another unexpected turn right there. And you mentioned one of the more intriguing things in the book about these sort of odd mafia kind of connections. Tell me about that.
My father ran a truck stop in Jersey City in the 40s and 50s, died in 1960. It was a tough place. It was if people have seen On the Waterfront, they get a sense of what things were like there, where you had the mafia, a couple of corrupt unions at the time, the Teamsters and the Longshoremen, both having significantly improved since, a very corrupt political machine based in Jersey City. And it was hard to be in some businesses without these kind of interconnections. And so my father's truck stop got him engaged with mob guys. Now, the trucking business at that time had some interesting elements. I remember my mother told me that when I was like 8 or 9, asked her why, if the case of ketchup had fallen off the truck, it hadn't broken. Well, obviously, my father had accepted a stray case of ketchup. And he had befriended some mafia guys.
This is before there were plastic bottles with ketchup.
Oh, absolutely. Good point. And he had a partner that he didn't get along with. The partner was kind of a thug. And when my father died, we were sort of at a disadvantage because the partner said, well, I can run the place. You guys can't run it. I was 20. I mean, I wasn't ready to quit my career and go into the truck stop business. And my father had been very nice to one particular guy who was a mafia associate, I think not a made man, as they said, had given him a job so he'd get out of jail on parole. And they decided, the mafia guys, to help my mother and me. And that kind of evened the odds, and we got a good deal, and we were able to get enough out of my father's business so we could keep going for a while.
You were at Harvard. You fell in love with politics. You fell in love with government. You had done even before Harvard. And you knew that that was something that was going to have to be at the core of your existence. But you had another thing at the core of your existence, which was your sexuality. That meant you basically decided you were going to be an academic because you thought that you could be true to yourself and true to your interests at the same time that way. But you got swept up by Kevin White.
Right. I mean, I thought the university was a good place from which to operate. I did think, okay, I can go to work for other people. I did have the model, for example, of the Kennedy administration, when a lot of professors, John Kenneth Galbraith, Arthur Schlesinger, and McGeorge Bundy, went to work. And I figured, this is great. You take a professorship. The academy is pretty well protected against these prejudices, not entirely, but it's the best shelter I'll find as a closeted gay man. And I can go out and work for somebody just long enough for them to start asking why you haven't seen me with a woman and go back. And I had taken a year off to write my PhD thesis, which was starting to come up against a deadline. And I got a call, actually from a prominent radio personality since then, a man named Chris Lydon, who was then a reporter for the Boston Globe. And here was the deal. Kevin White was a liberal but not particularly distinguished young Secretary of State, not a job in which you can do very much. And he was running against a racist, a woman named Louise Day Hicks, who this was at a time when African-Americans began to be concerned about school segregation, de facto segregation. They were trying to break out of a very racially confining situation in Boston. And she had risen to prominence as the leader of the white opposition. And the mayoral election, the final, came down to her and Kevin White. And I didn't know much about Kevin White, but I knew she was just awful. And, you know, to have Boston elect a racist would have just been a terrible thing. So I agreed to volunteer for him for a month because I had a thesis to write. I didn't have any teaching duties. And at the end of the month, White said to me, look, we get along well, and I like what you do. I'd like you to come to work for me. And that's how it happened. And again, this is a case where it was not anything I intended to do. Which became the key to my life, to become the mayor's chief assistant. The initiative entirely came from him to me.
It was before this that you were involved in the civil rights.
Mississippi Freedom Summer, 1964, when I was a graduate student. I had gotten to know, when I was still in college, a really extraordinary figure named Albert Lowenstein, who was murdered 35 years ago, not well known, but he was the ideal model of a zealous pragmatist, a guy who had deep ideals over race, but also over peace. But he was one of the best strategic and tactical thinkers I ever saw. And he was the one who first brought white people to Mississippi in 63. He brought them there to try to help a friend of his named Aaron Henry, who was running for governor and trying to help him campaign. And what happened was the white kids started getting beaten up. And all of a sudden it turned out that when white kids got beaten up in Mississippi by racists, it was a story. When black people got beaten up by racists in Mississippi, the state country didn't pay attention. So they organized the Freedom Summer in 64, which was kind of like a freedom ride writ large, to recruit hundreds of students from the North, including whites, not entirely, to go down and help out with this effort to, and the effort was this: very few blacks in Mississippi voted because they were physically not allowed to vote, and a few that managed to run the gauntlet got beaten or killed or lost their jobs. So we were down there to collect mock voter registrations to refute the lie that the reason blacks weren't voting is they didn't want to vote. And so, and we used that, and that was used to try to challenge the Mississippi Presidential Convention delegation, which was all white. So that was, and it worked. It worked very well. It worked too well because three guys were murdered. And that, of course, in a tragic way, helped turn the tide. It's an awful thing that it took that kind of sacrifice.
Former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank is my guest. We are talking about his career, about his points of view, and about his new book, Frank. Well, one of the biggest surprises for me in the book was how incredibly annoyed, you know, you often were with gay activists who were idealists, but who very often refused to be pragmatic.
And, yeah, and that, some that of
was
them.
Big frustration for you.
I got particularly annoyed when they did more harm than good. And one of the things that people in the LGBT movement would say to me, well, we take the model of the African Americans. I wish they did. I contrast the March on Washington in 64 and the gay march, or 63 rather, and the gay march of 93, 30 years apart. One of the great moral figures of my generation, your wonderful Congressman John Lewis, who's a continuing inspiration to people who care about good things, I remember him telling me that he had to submit four or five drafts of his speech to Bayard Rustin as the agent for A. Philip Randolph because he didn't want it to be too radical. At one point, John said, the people demand. I said, oh, no, we don't. I mean, they understood that the march in 63 was to persuade white people to be supportive. And you don't do that by insulting people and scaring them. You stress the commonality of the values and the fact you're being denied. There was a tendency among some gay people almost want to alienate others. And even when not, I mean, we have this general problem in America. When the right gets mad, they vote. When the left gets mad, they march. Occupy had drum circles. The Tea Party won primaries. I would rather my side win primaries, let the other side have the drum circles.
You cite the example of the NRA as as being a model that the LGBT forces should follow.
I don't
an analogy they probably don't like too much.
Well, I hope they understand it. As I said, I've given them the other one. I agreed much more with Occupy than with the Tea Party. I didn't agree entirely with Occupy. But Occupy had no impact on public policy, and the Tea Party sadly took over the Republican Party by voting and registering. The NRA, I mean, if demonstrations are so important, how come we've never seen a shoot-in or an NRA march? They don't march. They very systematically have everybody who's on their rolls call every representative, every senator, every state legislator, every city council member, and say, if you don't vote my way, I'm voting against you. And they vote. They vote in the primaries. They vote. Colorado did some good gun regulation after one of their tragedies. But then they had special elections over it. And in the first instance, even in Colorado where there was support, the anti-gun control people won because there were special elections, and every one of them voted. And the average citizen said, oh, I don't like this, but they stayed home.
You never shied away from a fight. You had the quickest tongue in Congress, and you had to deal with, especially after coming out, you had to deal with a lot of stuff being thrown your way, people calling you names in the well of the Congress, and some self-inflicted wounds as well. But, you have stepped away from the fight now. Do you see a positive future for Congress, given the unbelievably hard times we live in? It's very, from my perspective, it always seems there was a time for politics and then a time to get stuff done. And it seems like it's only time for politics now.
Well, you do need both. Look, people have said to me on one occasion, well, that issue was decided kind of politically. And the quick answer to that is, if you don't want a decision to be decided with a strong political input, don't ask 535 politicians to make it. But the mix is relevant. You're never going to have something totally non-political. Although I will tell you, we came close. And I'll take some credit for this. In 2008, when George Bush sent his top financial appointees, the Secretary of the Treasury and the head of the Federal Reserve, to Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, and they designated Chris Dodd and myself as the committee chairs to work with them, and they said, look, the economy is about to blow up. People are going to get really badly hurt. We literally, for about a month, didn't think about anything political. We were aware that some of what we were doing, in fact, might hurt some people, including us, but we said, yes, we got to do this. But that's the contrast I would make. In 2007 and 2008, the Democratic Congress was very cooperative with George Bush. You can read this in the books that his own people have put out. Then comes Barack Obama, and at that point, the right wing steps in, and they deny Obama that kind of cooperation. So the first thing I was saying is this dysfunctionality, which you correctly point out, is only a couple years old. It starts in 2011, really, when the Republicans take over the House. And it's not built into the system. It's electoral. It's because of the people who get elected. What I'm most rooting for now, may seem a little odd, is for mainstream conservative Republicans to take their party back. For Republicans
is
who
that
believe
possible?
If they vote in primaries, it is. And it's possible. It's a fair question. But here's what has to happen. If the Democrats win the next presidential election, that'll mean six out of the last seven presidential elections where the Democrat got more vote than the Republican, one of which the Republican won anyway in 2000, it will mean, and if we take back the Senate, at that point it will be such a defeat for the Republicans that I believe many of them will then say, the more reasonable ones, okay, we got to step up. Look, taking on the Tea Party isn't fun. You get attacked by Fox News. You get attacked by irresponsible right-wing talk show hosts. So people tend to shy away from that. But I believe self-preservation of the Republican Party might drive the more reasonable conservatives to get into it.
Tomorrow, we'll continue my conversation with Congressman Barney Frank.